Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is Hemant Mehta for the Friendly Atheist podcast. Dr. Daniel Dennett is a philosopher, professor at Tufts University, and author of several books, including Breaking the Spell and Darwin's Dangerous Idea. His research also led to the formation of The Clergy Project, an online forum for closeted religious leaders who no longer believe in God. His latest book is called From Bacteria to Bach and Back, and it's all about how our minds evolved. Dr. Dennett, thank you so much for being with me.
I'm delighted to join you, Hemant.
So let's get to the heart of this book, because why don't you describe your central thesis about what it's about? How do we get from bacteria to Bach? How did our minds evolve, you know, in like 30 seconds?
Well, the fact that our minds evolved is more important than a lot of, I think, people have realized that. Many of the features of our minds and of consciousness that seem baffling or mysterious or just inexplicable at first, if you set them all in the setting, the naturalistic setting of evolution, they begin to make more sense. And in particular, we can see how our minds, our human minds, depend on a secondary process of evolution, cultural evolution, which has filled our brains with thinking tools that we didn't have to design ourselves because they evolved culturally. Mainly that's language, but all the things that language enables, all the methods of thinking, the technology, the theories, and the rest that only we have access to. And it's what gives our minds power. It's what gives our brains power. My analogy, and it's a very strong analogy, actually, is with the apps you can put on your phone. If you have a phone that doesn't have any apps on it, it's not all that powerful. Every time you add an app, you add a new competence, a new set of abilities, new things you can do. Well, our brains are loaded with thousands and thousands of apps, which we acquire growing up in our cultures. And most of those apps were not invented by anybody. They evolved the same way the bird's wing evolved.
That makes it sound like other animals, other creatures could, in theory, develop the same quote-unquote apps.
Well, they could in theory. And I think the proper way of saying it is we're the only species so far on the planet that has evolved these capabilities. Plausible, if extremely unlikely, that some other species could pick up the same set of habits or similar sets of habits. And the fact that it's extremely improbable shouldn't tell us too much, because the whole point of evolution is that it's the amplification of extremely improbable events.
Let me ask you a completely theoretical question. It's always a fun mind game to ask this to scientists, but you know, if we could rewind the tape of life and start over from when we were single-celled organisms, if we were to evolve again, or at least, you know, starting evolution from a point where, you know, Homo sapiens were around, do you think we would develop the same set of apps or another type of app? Or is this unique to our development this one time around?
I think in a way the question's ill-posed. It depends on how far you want to wind back the tape. You wind back the tape, the existence of eukaryotes, of multicellular organisms made up of complex cells, is itself due to an accident that occurred more than 2 billion years ago, and it was an accident. It didn't have to occur. After all, there was a billion years before that when it didn't occur, when there was only single-celled living forms, and if you'd been in a time machine back then, and said, well, we've had a billion years of these single-celled, simple cells floating around in the water, I guess that's all that's ever going to happen. Well, you would have been majestically wrong. That's what I meant about the amplification of the improbable. Who knows? Evolution cannot really be predicted in that sense. Although we can, some people say, well, that means it's not really science. No, we can make billions of confirmable predictions based on evolutionary theory, but they're predictions of the scientific kind, not the soothsayer kind. For instance, I can predict with virtual certainty what the genes are going to be like in any bird you bring me from any place on the planet. Before I look at it, I can already tell you, well, I like a little help from some biologists and geneticists, because I'm not myself, an adept a sequencer of genomes. But there's simply no question at all about what we'll find inside that bird.
Now, this gets to the heart of something that we've long talked about, where when it comes to the God of the Gaps theory, this idea that how our consciousness evolved, that's always been one of those questions that, you know, in the case of evolution, we didn't really have an answer to. And it's one of the places that creationists, intelligent design proponents, they always say, well, that had to be an intelligent designer, that had to be God. And you're kind of going at the heart of that argument, saying, no, you don't have to fill that gap in with God. We have legitimate theories as to how this stuff could have happened. Was that kind of the reason you wanted to tackle this subject in particular? Or was this just, you know, this is the work I've been doing for like 50 years, and I wanted to bring this all together?
I think it's much more of the latter. But I certainly relish the fact that my account recognizes that the particular emergence of us has some really puzzling aspects to it. Like how did language ever evolve is a major puzzle still in evolutionary theory. And one of the things I wanted to do in the book is show, but don't give up, because we've got some amazing ideas about how it could happen. And if you acquire a few thinking tools that I try to provide for you, you'll be able to see not one, but a variety of different paths that'll take you all the way from bacteria to Bach without any mystery, without any skyhooks.
Now, what is it that you think we still don't understand about our mind and consciousness?
Well, there's many purely technical scientific things that we haven't really gotten to the heart of yet, but more important from my point of view as a philosopher, I guess, is that a lot of people, most people, still have a very hard time inverting their perspective, how it can be that their conscious experiences are the way they are without any miracles. It's tremendously tempting to think there's this inner show going on in a special medium somewhere. If it's not between your ears, it's in another dimension or something. It's the theater of consciousness. And that is an apparently eternally tempting idea, and it's just wrong. And I think we can show that it's wrong. The hard part is then saying, well, if that's wrong, what on earth can account for the way it seems to be right? And that's been a major preoccupation of mine for decades. And I think my new book sheds further light on that and makes it easier for people to take that last step and twist their heads around the idea. And then all of a sudden you can see, oh, I get it. There aren't any such things as qualia after all. There just seem to be qualia, and here's why.
Now, do you think we can ever get to the point that where we can understand our mind and consciousness? I think in your book you make a comparison that, you know, we don't necessarily understand everything about our mind and consciousness, as opposed to a natural phenomenon like gravity. You know, we understand that one pretty well. Do you think we'll ever get to the point where we could understand our minds as well as we understand something natural like gravity?
I think so, yes. But you have to bear in mind that there's understanding, and then there's a sort of an imaginary complete understanding. And we already know from, you know, theoretical work by Alan Turing, for instance, on the halting problem, that no information system can contain a complete representation of itself. So when you use your own brain to understand your own brain, you can make tremendous progress, and you can understand it, as it were, with a bird's eye view, and at various grain levels. But you can't ever achieve the perspective of the Laplacian demon about your own mind. You couldn't have such an understanding of your own mind that you could predict every future state.
Okay, let me ask you about this title, because it's a little freaky. The bacteria to Bach and back. Let's talk about this back thing. I assume this is like some thinly veiled Trump reference. Are we all going to die? Like, are we going back to bacteria?
Well, we are all going to die, but that's not, as I think you know.
I've heard.
But it's not a reference to Trump, but it is a reference to recent developments, which, in fact, have a lot to do with explaining the curious success of the Trump system at the moment. Francis Crick once made a joke about what he called Orgel's second rule: evolution is cleverer than you are. And there's some real truth in that. It's not that evolution has foresight and is intention and intentions. It's not a purposeful process. But it's brilliant at generating useful design from masses of data. And the data of all those lives lost in the course of evolution. And what we've recently developed in artificial intelligence and related fields are a whole variety of what we might call Darwinesque processes: deep learning, Bayesian networks, and several others that are amazingly good at pulling pattern out of noise, of extracting information from humongous databases and then making it available to us. So in other words, you can have an evolutionary process that does the heavy lifting for you. So now we are using these more and more. They're a wonderful new set of tools. But one of the features of them that worries many of us is that when we use them, we don't understand how the machines got the results they did. We do in general. We understand it well enough to know why we ought to rely on them in general, although not always. But what this may mean is that with regard to large areas of science, we will put ourselves in the same position that most of us are now in, or our children are, with regard to navigation and driving. GPS is just so good that people's ability to read maps and to plan routes in their own heads is plummeting, use it or lose it. And it looks as if comprehension itself is beginning to be abandoned as a goal in science and as a goal in life. Why bother comprehending if you've got this hardware that can do the Darwinian hard work of extracting information, and we'll just trust it? So we're on the verge of becoming very, very much more dependent on our technology than we already are, and that's dangerous because that technology, in spite of the brilliance of its design, is actually much more brittle and fragile than a lot of people are prepared to realize, and we could have an almost unimaginable catastrophic collapse of the whole system. It could happen tomorrow or next week, and that wouldn't throw us all the way back to, it wouldn't mean that bacteria would resume control of the planet, although that's one prospect, but it could mean that Homo sapiens, our species, was pretty well removed from any human civilization and culture altogether, and revert to a condition not unlike Mad Max and Road Warrior.
What sort of catastrophe are you talking about? What could theoretically happen that would ruin the dependence we have on technology?
Could the internet, the whole internet, could it go down? Could it collapse? Yes. I talk with experts who say it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. It will happen. For how long will it go down? Nobody knows. Well, so what? Couldn't we live without the internet for a while? Yes, but the internet is such a convenient and excellent way of doing things that too many things have become really dependent on them. It is not unlikely that if the internet went down, it would take the power grid with it. It would take the television news with it. It would take cell phones with it. We would be plunged into electronic darkness. Well, what's so bad about that? Until in the 19th century, everybody was in electronic darkness, and we got on quite well with modes of transportation and communication. Yes, but today we're not used to that. We don't know how to cope with that. If we were plunged into electronic darkness, we would panic. And the damage done by the panic could really destroy civilization. I think people would do all sorts of regrettable and ultimately stupid things, but they would do it out of fear and out of hasty reasoning about what can I possibly do to protect my loved ones and myself? With whom do I join forces? And we could really be in the soup.
Now, going back to the thesis of your book, though, is this, if this is something that may happen in the future at some point or something, is this something we could even avoid? Is there a way to not be as dependent on this stuff anymore and get back to, you know, our roots in a sense?
Or yes, there is.
What can we do?
What we can do is, first of all, start anticipating this in some detail and talking about it and getting people in general to understand that this is a problem and to recognize that the great enemy is panic. And now we can ask ourselves, well, how could we prevent that panic? Well, panic is extremely contagious. So what you have to do is you have to nip it in the bud, because once it gets underway, everybody gets swept along. So we have to have panic absorbers. We have to have things in place that will prevent people from, it will more or less immunize them against spreading panic. And what could do that? Well, it's got to be other memes. It's got to be other thinking tools, other apps that we install in our brain, so that when this terrible thing happens, we're already, we have, the first thing that occurs to us is, now let's see, where's my local panic absorber group? Where do they meet? And what this means is we have to have local, bottom-up community groups who have not only been thinking about this and knowing who's got the electric generators, who are the ham radio operators, who knows how to run a mimeograph machine so we can put posters up around in the streets, who can fix a diesel engine? Where is there some extra fuel? And so forth and so on. And if it was just common knowledge among people that if this happens, I know where to go or I know who to consult, then that's what you do. Instead of running off half-cocked and arming yourself and starting to dig a fallout shelter or doing something really stupid like that, you more or less calmly join forces with your local group and see what they already know and see how you can help. And creating such a network of trust among local groups of people, and we would have to, I figure we would have to create, 100,000, more than 100,000 of these around the country, and they should be pretty much self-creating. This is what I see as a putting in place a social network of social networks of small groups, which could absorb the panic and keep everybody together and calm and nobody worrying about starving. Let's say for 48 hours, and that would probably be time to get things up and running again. It would be a great experience.
On that optimistic note, that's a literal social network right there. Let me ask you about the writing process in general, because one thing I always appreciate about your books is that, you know, at the ends of all of your chapters, you summarize everything so well and you kind of prepare us for the next one, like we're all in on this journey together. And I mean, I know a lot of authors do that, like here's what's coming ahead, but you're very deliberate in how you summarize what you're saying, how you prepare us at the beginning of a chapter or something. I'm just wondering, I don't see that style with a lot of authors. How did you develop that?
I'm not sure how to answer that. Consciousness Explained, I had my summaries and predictions. I'm still doing it, but not quite so self-consciously. I guess the reason I developed it, the problem I had to try to solve, was that, ever since I was a fledgling philosopher professor, I've realized that my particular perspective has a lot of parts, and I can't summarize them in 5 minutes or 10 minutes. I can't. You know, at a cocktail party, if somebody says, well, what's your view? I'm in a bad position. Unless I back him into a corner and say, you got 45 minutes? I'll give you my view. I just have to settle for giving a few pieces, and it's very unlikely that anybody will see how they might all fit together. So it's always been a problem for me to try to figure out which order should I expose these ideas and present them, and I run into these vicious circles. I have to explain A before anybody would understand B, and B before anybody would understand C. But if I don't, if people don't already understand C, how are they going to understand A? And I guess my ideal would be to write a book that, as you read it, you actually think, wait a minute, now I see what he was doing back in chapter one. You go back and you read chapter one, and now it comes clear. And you sort of cycle through the book, looking back, looking forward, looking back, looking forward. And then in my dream world, when you get to the end of the book, you start over again. And then it's all, now I see how the pieces fit together. I was so pleased that Michael Gazzaniga, in his review in the Wall Street Journal, ended by saying pretty much just that. This is a book to read and then read again.
That's awesome. What's your process for something as dense as this one? Because you have a lot of theories, you have a lot of analogies, and I'm wondering, who do you run them by? Not just to make sure they're scientifically sound, but to make sure you're thinking about this the right way.
Oh, good question. And if you look at my preface, you'll see a lot of people get thanked. And my whole career, I have leaned heavily on colleagues, informants, and students to steer me, fix things that are not quite right, and particularly for students to look puzzled and frowny and baffled, which, when I see that, provokes me to try again harder. And out of many, many, many attempts to explain these ideas, first of all, the ideas shift and change and get better, and that also my ability to explain them gets better. And I lose track of whose obstructionism, whose foot dragging, whose quizzical look provoked me to come up with yet another analogy, yet another thought experiment. But it's a process that has been cycling vigorously for 50 years.
And this particular book, I know, is the culmination of a lot of the work you've done. But in the particular writing of it, like, how long have you been working on this specific book?
Oh, I don't know how to calculate that or how to answer, because, as you say, there's parts of it that I'd pretty well worked out in talks and earlier papers, even more than a decade ago. And one of the hardest things about writing the book was coming up with fresh ways of saying things which I thought I'd said pretty well the last time, and not wanting to just quote myself, and not wanting to write a book that people couldn't read if they hadn't read my earlier books. I wanted it to be a standalone book, and that was a very tough writing job. And I think the hardest writing job I've ever had.
Well, I have one last question for you before I let you go, which is, I saw that you have an art collection going up soon called Haptic Whittles, which I love that name. But two questions about this, I think. One is, where do you find time in all of this to do art, to make these things that you're going to display? And where does that side come from?
Well, first of all, the pieces that are going to be displayed are all of them at least 20 years old. I haven't done as much art in the last 20 years as I have done earlier. But I started out when I was in college. It was I going to be a sculptor or was I going to be a philosopher? And I had some initial successes in both realms. And when I went to Oxford to do my graduate work, I stopped off in Athens on the summer before and got a big block of Pendelic marble and began hacking away at that just because I wanted to get some familiarity with marble as a medium in sculpture. And then over the years, made pieces in many different media. And but although I showed pieces in galleries when I was in college, really, I grew to dislike the art world, not artists, but critics, gallery owners, and buyers. I grew to dislike them so much that I decided, well, I won't do this. I'll give them to people, or I'll just keep them myself, or they're for friends and family. And so I've pretty well shunned the art world. But this fellow, Nicholas Cueva, who heard about my pieces, began pestering me very, very politely and very, very flatteringly about, oh, two or three years ago. And I kept saying, no, they're not for sale. No. Besides, they're meant to be handled, but in a museum or in a gallery, people would be. I couldn't have all that many people come in and handle them. There, they might get broken or stolen or whatever. And so I put him off until his most recent inquiry. And I thought, well, okay, let's see if we can do it. So you're not going to be able to handle them, although that's what they're for. But they're going to be there under behind plexiglass. And there's a video, carefully done video, of somebody manipulating them, handling them. And so you get to see how sort of seductive they are as things to explore in your hands.
So if the internet goes down, we know what you're going to be doing.
Oh yeah, I've always got a very sharp jackknife in my pocket, and it's always a piece of wood lying around somewhere.
Very nice. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Daniel Dennett. His new book is From Bacteria to Bach and Back. We'll have links to the book as well as his art exhibit in the show notes. Thanks again.
And thanks, Hema. I enjoyed it very much.